As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast Weekend Preview as we look ahead to match day 3 in the Premier League. I'm Tim Spears, back at the Athletics HQ in London, standing in for Adam Leventhal in the hot seat this week while he's away on his jollies, presumably hoping that Watford don't sack their manager. In fact, who is Watford's manager these days? Nope, moving on. Okay. Right, we're here every Friday to set up the weekend's action, and with me this week, he's back once again. We can't get rid of him, slash, it's lovely to see you. It's Nick Miller.
I'm just constantly available. That's the thing. There's nothing more to it than that, I don't think.
Nick's excited, everybody. I can hear it. You're extra excited because you're very pleased with yourself, having just eaten your lasagna leftovers.
Homemade lasagna. Just want to clarify that homemade by me, from scratch. Yeah, but I am feeling a little bit sluggish now, having eaten quite a lot of it for lunch.
Sluggish and smug. That's our Nick. Nick's excited. I can feel it. I'm excited. We've got two debutants on the show joining Nick this week. We're going to start with the magnificent Ruben Pinder.
Hello.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. For those who aren't familiar with your work, clue the listener in. Who the hell are you, Ruben?
I'm that guy off the Athletic's TikTok account.
Knew it. So, knew I'd seen you somewhere.
Go and follow us on there if you don't have 20 minutes to read an in-depth feature. We'll do our best to sum it up for you. It's good fun. But yeah, thanks for having me.
Read the feature as well, though.
Obviously.
Listeners. Yeah. We're going to move on to our second debutant, the wonderful Nnamdi Onyegwara.
How you doing?
Is that a good pronunciation?
That was a fantastic pronunciation.
Oh, okay,
thank you very much.
Nnamdi, tell us who you are and where you come from. I was going to do the Cilla Black just for Nick, but then I thought, no, we'll just leave it.
Part of the news team. So I'm very grateful that you dragged me from the busy news desk today to talk about a bit of football. But yeah, for like a young player that's just been promoted at the youth academy, so I can press the gaffer and do well my debut today.
Right, onto the football. Mr. Leventhal likes his fixture formations, as we know. This weekend we've got a split of 1-6-3, one being a match on Friday for the uninitiated. Six games on Saturday and three on Sunday. I don't know why he keeps doing this, but I'm going to carry it on in his absence. So yeah, the fixtures we've got an intriguing clash on Friday night at Stamford Bridge with Chelsea v Luton. Then on Saturday, Bournemouth take on rejuvenated Spurs in the early kickoff. Then at 3 p.m, it's Arsenal versus an Alexander Mitrovic less Fulham. Brentford, who look fine without Ivan Toney, take on Crystal Palace. Then it's 19th v 20th at Goodison Park as dreadful Everton take on the mighty and underrated Wolverhampton Wanderers. And then in what's a very rare event, Manchester United have a Saturday 3 p.m. kickoff against Nottingham Forest. Then in the late game, Brighton will look to maintain their 100% record when they host West Ham. And then on Sunday, it's Burnley Villa, it's Sheffield United Man City, and the most lip-licking game, I think we can all agree, of the weekend is Newcastle v Liverpool. So that's where we're going to start. Newcastle-Liverpool, 4:30 p.m. UK time on Sunday. Newcastle were fairly comfortably seen off by Man City last weekend, losing 1-0 at the Etihad. And Liverpool have looked pretty vulnerable so far at the back. Conceded within 3 minutes against Bournemouth and looked a bit shambolic. So I guess the question we're sort of asking of these two is, can either of them really be taken seriously as title contenders? Ruben, I'll come to you on this one to start with. I mean, it's early in the season, but from what you've seen, can either of these two realistically expect to challenge what we assume will be Man City and Arsenal?
I don't think so. But if I were to back either of them to sustain a challenge to what is now kind of the big two, it would be Liverpool, because they've just got more quality in attack. Well, they've got more quality in their starting 11, but there are obviously fragilities in that team, especially in defensive midfield. I'd be intrigued to see how Endo gets on in his first few games, because he was obviously like quite far down their list of number sixes to get. But interestingly, like, I'm far from the first person to say this, but Newcastle in their current iteration remind me of early Klopp's Liverpool. You know, they play the same system. It's very energy focused. They're brilliant in transition, but then they're going to have to adapt to having Champions League football. And obviously Liverpool are in the Europa League, which that Sunday, Thursday grind, that extra knockout round, that won't help them out. So realistically, I don't think either of them will push the top two, but I could very realistically see them finishing third and fourth, but maybe with a little bit of a gap in between.
That's the first time I've heard that Newcastle Klopp thing. We obviously mix in very different sort of football circles.
Do you see what I mean, though?
Yeah, no, totally. Yeah, yeah, it's a decent analogy. Newcastle signed Lewis Hall this week on loan. Probable £35 million deal to follow. I'm going to be honest here. I'd heard of Lewis Hall, but in terms of a £35 million sign, you know, when you think that Alan Shearer was the world record at £15 million, and now this kid, I mean, he's a kid, potentially for £35 million, I don't know a huge amount about him. Can anyone enlighten me? Is anyone a keen Lewis Hall fan?
Not sure if I'd go as far as say keen Lewis Hall fan, but I know last season he kind of broke onto the scene. I remember him playing 2-3 times. I think I remember Chelsea playing City about 3 times in a week around January, and he played in all 3 games and he was really, really good, held his own against Mahrez. So I think Newcastle might have got him for his versatility, obviously his age, and hopefully he can have a similar impact that Livramento could have on the other side as well.
I mean, you mentioned Livramento, yeah, the second sort of Chelsea Academy graduate that they've signed this window. Do you feel like, Nam, do you feel like that's his smart recruitment, you know, looking and building for the long term?
Yeah, I would say it looks like Newcastle are trying to solve problems before they become a problem. So before Trippier's too old, I mean, the replacement's already there. If you have questions about Dan Burn, there's a complete different option now at left back. So I think it's smart recruitment and it should be praised.
Nick, I guess the big question for Newcastle, can they combine what we expect will be a decent push in the Champions League while trying to maintain what they did in the Premier League last season? I mean, they have, yeah, as we said, some decent recruitment, but combining those two is going to be really difficult.
Yeah, and it's something that not too many of their players will have experienced before. Their manager hasn't experienced that before. Just kind of thinking off the top of my head through that starting 11, Trippier will have played in the Champions League for Spurs and Atletico. Is there anyone else?
Isak might have played for Sociedad,
Tonali. But yeah, a very difficult thing to get used to. Just kind of back on Lewis Hall, I think it's just Andy was right in that he looked quite impressive when he played for Chelsea last season, but it's always quite difficult to assess those young players that come into a team which are otherwise completely joyless and dreadful, because they kind of look really good, but you don't know if they are quite as good as they look in comparison to the rest of the team. So if he kind of gets a bit of a go in what is already a pretty good team, we'll have a kind of better understanding of how good he actually is.
I think it was important for Newcastle to sign a player like Lewis Hall, because their backup to Dan Burn last season was Matt Target, right? And he's not quite at the level that you'd want if you're playing in the Champions League. And also, Dan Burn is a very specific type of player, and you know, when Potter put him at left back, I remember everybody sort of questioning it. He's this like gangly centre half playing at left back, but he's done very well. But it's nice to have for them to have that other option, where more of a traditional attacking fullback.
I think we're all pretty confident that Newcastle are going in a certain direction, upward curve. But Liverpool, it's hard to call really. They were shambolic against Bournemouth last week. They could have conceded 3 in the opening 10 minutes, and that was with their first choice back five just making, you know, what felt like really basic defensive errors. But strangely, it might not feel like it, but Liverpool on the longest unbeaten run in the Premier League, 13 games, stretching back to when they lost to Man City in April. But Ruben, they haven't felt convincing in any way, really.
No, they seem like the sort of team who, you know, this unbeaten run might continue. They might draw 2-2 against Newcastle. That feels like quite a feasible result. And, you know, in the absence of having that really solid midfield, like you compare the current midfield that they've got, so let's say Endo comes back in and he's playing behind McAllister and Szoboszlai, compare that to Fabinho, Henderson, Wijnaldum, the midfield three that won the Champions League, the one from 4 years ago is a lot more rock solid and kind of transitional, I guess. So they're going to have to adapt how they play. I feel like they'll probably win a lot of games 4-3 this season, which will be fun for the neutral and stress inducing for the fans. But yeah, that is one of the most surprising stats I've heard, because it really doesn't feel like they are that kind of invincible team at the moment.
Namdi, they're sort of persisting with this box midfield, as it's called, with Trent Alexander-Arnold sort of pushing inside. Is that something that they'll continue with for the rest of the season? Is that Klopp's idea, or is that more of a short-term fix?
I think, I can't say if they will, but I think they should. I think Trent is way, way too talented technically to be wasted out at fullback. I think we saw it towards the end of last season. I think we saw it in a couple England games over the summer as well. I think getting Trent involved in build-up, especially with Endo coming into a new league, if Endo is going to reprise this role that Fabinho made his own for years, if Trent is going to tuck inside there, I think it just helps Liverpool maintain possession, dominate games, and if it is a steer away from the rock and roll football that we saw from years ago, if they are trying to dominate games now, I think Trent has to be in that box.
It feels like they haven't quite got used to the idea of covering the right-hand side when Alexander-Arnold moves into midfield. Man City, obviously, they use this system slightly differently, but they are very good at that, of the whole defence kind of shifting over. What is also interesting is how it will, by moving Alexander-Arnold into midfield, whether that will kind of stymie Robertson on the left, obviously kind of been a brilliant attacking option for them for a long time.
Excellent use of the word stymie there.
Thank you.
Which I haven't heard on a podcast in a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. We expect Endo to probably start. Alexis McAllister can play. His ridiculous red card against Bournemouth, rightly overturned, I'm sure we all agree. I guess if they both play and Tonali and Bruno play, that feels like a really key area to this game, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Liverpool will probably have Trent in that area of the pitch. The midfield battle will be crucial. Newcastle's midfield is, as I said earlier, like a classic Klopp midfield. It's full of energy. Bruno Guimaraes is not the type of, you know, six who just kind of sits deep. He gets about as well. And Tonali showed on his debut how dangerous he can be in attack as well, kind of making box crashing runs. I would be favouring Newcastle for this game personally, because I think, kind of as Nick alluded to, the box midfield system that Liverpool play, it solves one problem, but then it kind of causes others.
So Ruben favours Newcastle for this one. Namdi, who do you fancy?
Yeah, I favour Newcastle as well.
Nick?
Yeah, Newcastle, high scoring, high octane affair.
Tune in then. For more on Liverpool and Newcastle, you can check out our Walk On or Pod on the Tyne podcast.
Tony Evans here, your host of the Athletic's dedicated Liverpool podcast, Walk On. The Reds have a new captain, a new look midfield, and we're ready for the new season. Join me, along with our stable of Liverpool writers, including James Pearce.
For me, this is succession planning.
Simon Hughes.
They need a lot to go their way in a short space of time to set the team up for a successful season, I'd say.
And Kiva O'Neill.
Feel ready now for the season.
We're with you weekly each Wednesday on Apple, Spotify, and all major podcast platforms.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Right, next up, Manchester United hosts Knicks Nottingham Forest. that sort of makes it sound like Nick's the manager. But as far as we know, it's still Steve Cooper.
I would not dare to presume to be in place of the mighty Steve Cooper.
Yeah, as we said earlier, this one's 3 p.m. Saturday in the UK. And for United, it comes after a pretty alarming defeat to Spurs last weekend. Nick, we'll come to you, given your Forest allegiances. United on a 7-game winning streak at home. Forest, one away league win in a year. That's calendar year. But you'd imagine, I guess, given the performances of the two teams in their opening two games, it's not as cut and dried as a home banker.
No, I mean, it's United were so weird last weekend because they weren't very good, but they equally could have been a couple of goals up at half time. So, you know, are we going to be talking about, would we be talking about them very differently? In that case, obviously Mason Mount's not playing. No one's really sure if that's a good or a bad thing for United at the moment, kind of just figuring out what he's doing there.
And injured Forest, at the moment, not playing at the weekend.
Yes, yeah. Yep. And yeah, an awful lot of that, the poor away results were last season when Forest Cooper hadn't really figured out the kind of jumble of players that he had been given towards the back end of the season. And to a point against Arsenal, on the first day of this season, they were much more solid, pretty good on the counter-attack, as they showed with the goal against Arsenal. And Taiwo Wonyi's, you know, in God mode at the moment, scored in, what was it, six straight games. So that they, in theory, they have the perfect players to do the, you know, play 5-4-1 and hit teams on the counter-attack, which, again, is in theory, would be the way to go against United at Old Trafford.
Goals are the problem for United. I mean, they only scored 58 last year. Marcus Rashford was, you know, the very obvious source of goals, but it was a freak season by his normal scoring standards. So, Ruben, I mean, if you can't produce that level again, where do the goals come from for United?
They come from Bruno Fernandes' long shots, I guess. Like, it's a tricky one for them, especially with like Hoyland coming in. Obviously he hasn't played in the Premier League yet. Will he hit the ground running? Because like, I know he cost a lot of money and people are excited about him, but his goal scoring record in Italy doesn't scream guaranteed success in his first season. So they are still really reliant on Rashford, and obviously that worked at times last season because he had some purple patches, like just after the World Cup, but he had other quiet spells as well.
It doesn't feel like creativity is a huge problem. I mean, they've had an XG of 4.28 in their first two games, obviously just the one goal. They will make at least one change here, as we said. Mason Mount's injured till after the international break. But Antony and Garnacho played both games, Namdi, and not really massively impressed. Is it Sancho time, or what other changes can you see Ten Hag making?
I think that's a good point. I think the debate on Rashford as a nine has gone on for way too long. I think that should have been dead and buried years ago. I know with Hoyland's injury, and Red Cross ain't there anymore, so there's not really the backboard to play off. But I think, I mean, we saw the Sancho false nine trial in pre-season. That didn't go too badly. So I think desperate times call for desperate measures for United at the moment. I think that might be time to bring Sancho back in. I agree with Ruben that I thought Mount would have fitted in well in that midfield, but as it's shown so far, it's not really worked. And I don't think United should be against maybe bringing McTominay back in as a left number eight. And if Casemiro does feel a bit isolated, I know McTominay will bring in some athleticism, maybe be a bit more robust, help him defensively. And we've seen how McTominay can be used for Scotland as well and make late runs into the box and get onto goals as well. So I think, yeah, there probably is this weekend probably the best time to make some iterations to that team.
Desperate times call for Sancho. Which made that the title of this podcast. Hope you're not listening, Jaden.
He tunes in every week.
Yeah, a lot's been made of Casemiro's sort of start to the season. Not exactly being written off, but people saying, you know, can he reproduce the levels of last season? What have you made of him and United's midfield, Nick?
It does sort of feel like the way some people are talking about him is, oh, he's finished, he's old, he's 32 years old. Or
I think he's just 30.
He's just 30. Well, 30. There you go. Ancient.
31.
But as Namdi says, I think it would be a good idea to put someone a little bit more solid next to him, and not trying to overstate the dynamic threat of Nottingham Forest. But the way that Forest will probably play, they will have two kind of slightly more sitting midfielders, and then ahead of them Morgan Gibbs-White and Danilo. And they were, if it was just Casemiro playing in that kind of area, those two will not leave him alone. They will kind of swarm all over him. They'll be absolute pains in the ass to play against. So I think possibly giving him a little bit more help might be a decent idea for this game. Whether, you know, Manchester United will countenance making a more defensive plan to deal with Nottingham Forest, I don't know. But,
well, the fringe players didn't exactly do themselves justice in a friendly against Burnley midweek, because they lost 3-0 behind closed doors. That was mostly fringe players.
Is that weird? Why? There's a couple of teams have been doing that, playing like behind closed doors friendlies in the third week of the season. Is this just a sort of fitness thing?
It seems bizarre to me. Like, it's during an international break, maybe.
Yeah.
But like just after the season has started, like, it's bizarre.
Yeah, July's the time for that, isn't it? Right. That's how it goes.
Is it like a kind of the pre-season isn't what it used to be kind of thing? It's all, you know, tours now, and it's not about getting fitness up. So they're using the Tuesday before Saturday game for this instead.
I'm not sure. It does feel quite overly intense. And I know Karl Anka's piece was speaking about United players potentially being a bit overburnt as well. So I can't think a friendly against Burnley midweek would help.
But at least Donny van der Beek gets to kick a ball.
That's nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Poor Donny.
Bless him. As for Forrest, the one news, he said the obvious danger man. Scored in his last 6 Premier League appearances, although judging from his celebrations, he's not too happy about it.
I haven't really got to the bottom of it. He's extremely religious, and I kind of wonder whether that was part of it. He's just kind of taking a moment to thank God rather than celebrate wildly. But yeah, who knows?
He looks kind of angry about it, though. Like,
yeah, it's, well, I don't know. I don't think he looks angry. It's more, I think there's slightly more of the, yeah, well, of course I've scored, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bit of the Balotelli celebrate. When
A little bit. How dare you think any differently of me kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, Elise is similar. Do you remember his free kick against United last season? He just didn't look bothered at all.
Yeah.
Namdi, Nick's made a pretty good case for Forrest, at least giving him a game on Saturday. Who are you leaning towards for this one?
Yeah, you know what? I think I'll agree with Nick on that one. Yeah, I think Forrest gave him a good game. I think,
blimey,
I think they were really good when they came to him a couple of weeks ago, and I think they'll get the result.
Ruben?
I'll go for a narrow United win.
Nick. Yeah, I think that's probably most realistic. I mean, if Forrest play like they did in the second half against Arsenal, it would be a good game. If they play in the second half, play like they did in the second half against Sheffield United, then they'll get absolutely battered. So I suspect it will probably be narrow and unconvincing United win.
Ah, oh, Nick, you left me out.
I know. Sorry. I was just playing devil's advocate. You know, I've got friends who won't sort of forgive me if I do Forest down a podcast like this. So.
Excellent. Right, for much more on Man United, check out Andy Mitten, Laurie Whitwell, Karl Anka and Ian Irving on our Talk of the Devils podcast.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right, it's very, very, very early in the season, but Everton v Wolves on Saturday feels like a bit of a big one. Everton are 20th, Wolves are 19th, unjustly. It's been called the broke derby in the script here. I'm not sure that's quite going to catch on, but obviously both teams have got some serious financial issues. I mean, Wolves have had to sell a lot of players this summer: Ruben Neves, Connor Cody, Raul Jimenez, Nathan Collins. They've lost Moutinho and Traore on a free. There are still more sales to come, possibly one to the Champions, which we'll talk about in a bit. Meanwhile, Everton dealt a huge blow this week when US investment firm MSP Capital pulled the plug on a minority stake in the club. Here's Matt Slater doing his best Margot Robbie in the bath impression from The Big Short. Obviously, that's a reference everyone knows. To explain the collapse of the deal between MSP Capital and Everton on yesterday's episode of the Daily Football Briefing.
Here's Margot Robbie in a bubble bath to explain.
Well, a deal that Everton owner Farhad Moshiri has been working on for months, and most of this year, in fact, has collapsed. MSP Capital, a New York-based sports investment fund, were going to lend money to both Everton, the football club, and Everton Stadium Company, the subsidiary that's been set up to build a new stadium at Bramley Moor Dock. And this money, up to 150 million, was going to be in convertible debt, was going to be basically a loan with warrants that could convert into equity. And this was going to give MSP a stake of up to 25% in the club and provide crucial £100 million toward the stadium build, which still needs another 360 million or so to complete. It was then going to give confidence to further lenders, basically JP Morgan and a Japanese bank. But as well as the stadium, it was also going to provide much needed working capital for the club, which has been losing money for years, as everyone knows, is facing a Premier League independent investigation over overspending, and is just right up against it in terms of FFP, has been through two relegation battles, is facing a third, and badly needs some money. They've only spent one transfer fee. They've only brought in, I think, three players. So this money is badly needed, and it's not now going to arrive. Now, MSP had an exclusivity period. It's up. The deal is dead. They're still going to make the loan to the stadium development company, but they are not going to do the equity deal. It's just going to be a straightforward commercial loan. That means the Everton Football Club side of it, They're short of cash. They still face the same cash flow problems, and Moshiri still faces the same funding deficit in terms of the stadium co. So this is very concerning.
Got it? Okay.
Namdi, I don't know if you saw Everton against Villa the other day, but they were truly disgusting in defence. it was insane. Just doesn't feel like a Sean Dyche team.
Yeah, no, at the moment it really doesn't. I still think that some of the components are there. I mean, I know they lined up with their trademark Gay, Onana and Doucouré midfield. I do feel like his reliance on Michael Keane is, if it's not cost him already, I mean, I don't know when the penny will drop. I know he made another mistake last week. But I mean, I think there are signs on a traditional Dyche team. And I think Calvert-Lewin would have been his Chris Wood, Ashley Barnes, if he could stay fit. I know his recent injury was really, really unfortunate, but Neil Mopey just doesn't fit the mould of that big number nine. I think Ellis Sims had potential to fit that mould, but he's been shipped off to Coventry. But yeah, I mean, there was energy and creativity on the wings with McNeil and Iwobi last season, but they're both injured as well for Saturday. So I think there are signs for an athletic and robust Dyche team. I think there are signs of the teams of Dyche that we've seen over the years, but with like the mounting injuries, the lack of investment, uncertainty around the club and the fans, it does look quite bleak again for them.
Blimey, anything else? I mean, yeah, the defence was terrible the other day. Ruben, they only scored 34 last season. As Namdi says, Dominic Calvert-Lewin picked up what was a really nasty-looking injury. You know, I guess it's unlikely he'll play any part this weekend. Can you see anything other than a season of struggle for Everton?
No, not after, you know, this recent news, the injuries they've got, the fact that Michael Keane starts every week. It's not looking good. Like, they were so reliant on Calvert-Lewin being fit and in form, and, you know, if he wasn't there, then Richarlison, and they just can't rely on Calvert-Lewin even being available. Unfortunately for him and the club, and yeah, without Richarlison, they really lack any kind of cutting edge up top. And I've noticed like their last few starting 11s, it must be injury induced, like because McNeil's not available. But they seem to basically play five central midfielders, and you know, and whoever up top. But it's like, you know, Doucouré, Gay, Onana, they're all good players. And, you know, James Garner and Iwobi, I rate both of them as well, but they're not right and left-sided midfielders. Like, Iwobi actually, one of the few good things that Frank Lampard did was move Iwobi into like a number eight position. So, yeah, the starting 11 doesn't inspire hope at all. And, you know, having seen how well Wolves played in their defeat against United, I would definitely expect them to win this game.
Steady on, don't say that. you can't say that. Nick, Everton, any hope?
No, not really. I mean, it does. Matt has explained his piece there, but the kind of short version is they appear to be screwed. And particularly if, it's difficult to come to any conclusion other than Dominic Calvert-Lewin is cursed, because obviously his injury last weekend was not like a repeatable thing. It's not like his hamstring went again or whatever. It feels like the kind of narrow midfield thing is a sort of circumstance thing, because they've signed Jack Harrison, who's currently injured, and Dan Juma, so it feels like they do want to play with wingers. They just haven't got them at the moment. They signed Yusuf Chemeti, the kid from Sporting. Yeah. Earlier on Thursday, I think Sean Dyche was asked. He basically said he's not fit yet, and someone quite reasonably said, "Well, why didn't you sign a player who was kind of fit to play?" And he basically said, "Well, this is the player. This is the deal we could get done. We couldn't sign anyone else." Which, even if it's true, don't say that. Just kind of build a kid's confidence up. Then you don't say, "Well, he was around, so we bought him. Couldn't really get anyone else." But yeah, that. I don't hold a huge amount of optimism for Everton. I mean, I don't hold a huge amount of optimism for Wolves either, but you'll know kind of more about that than us, Tim. Is there any sort of significant optimism for Wolves this season? The kind of look on your face suggests not really.
That's just the way I always look. I don't know. I was quite optimistic before Lopetegui left, because he was their sort of trump card last season. The squad itself is pretty good. There's an awful lot of talented players there. But once he's gone and Gary O'Neill's come in, it just signals we're just trying to stay up this season. And if O'Neill can't command the respect of these players, a lot of whom have sort of swapped the Champions League to come here for Lopetegui or previous managers, if O'Neill can't get the respect of them and get them playing, then... Yeah, you really worry for them. I mean, the sort of narrative after the Man United game, which I know a lot of people saw because it was on the Monday night, was that, if Wolves play like that every week, they'll be fine. But I was just like, no, we scored 31 goals last season. If we can't score from that many shots, how do we score? And then, it's a similar story as Brighton, but obviously with horrendous defensive issues. So, no, not optimistic. We've got a lot of very pretty, very attractive players, but no one to finish off the chances, and the defence looks a bit leaky now as well. So
I always thought that there was a game a few years ago, which was QPR against Reading, and I think it was ended 0-0, a result which meant both teams went down. And I always previously thought that was the saddest Premier League game of all time, but it feels like this one is really going to give it a run for its money.
Was that the one where Jose Bosengua was seen just kind of having laughing on the pitch after the final whistle?
I think you're not really narrowing it down there. I think he did that quite a lot when he was at QPR. But I think Harry Redknapp and Nigel Adkins were the managers, I think, and at the end of the game, it was just like, oh, well, never mind.
Yeah,
it's a shame, isn't it? But yeah, I don't know whether I could sort of bring myself to watch this game of the weekend. It just feels too bleak.
Well, you can't. It's not on telly.
Even the highlights.
You can refuse to watch Match
Not going to refuse to watch it, but yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen Mateus Nunes, the subject of a surprise bid from Man City. I mean, Pep Guardiola's, spoken very highly of Nunes in the past, but still, he had a terrible season last year. I don't know if any of you guys have got a particular opinion on Nunes and whether he would fit into Man City's formation or system, or is he good enough to even, play for Man City?
Well, they're changing. They seem to be evolving their shape again, City, which makes that a little bit difficult to answer, really, because they settled on a system last season, everybody copied them, and now they're kind of tweaking it again to adapt to the absence of Mahrez and now De Bruyne. So, I mean, Did Nunes not score an absolute worldie against Chelsea last season?
That was the one thing he did all season, literally.
Right, but nothing else?
No, nothing. So he spent the whole season looking like he'd been told he was moving to Liverpool at the end of his first season, which was the strong rumour as to how Wolves had managed to bring him in. Because he was so highly rated when he was at Sporting. And, you know, I don't want to accuse players of... But anyway, he just looked like he didn't want to be there. And then against Brighton the other day, I don't know if you saw his absolutely ludicrous red card where he's already on a yellow and then he pushes not one, not two, but maybe three Brighton players. It's like, I really don't fancy going to Goodison Park this week. So, not great. We'll see what happens with that one. Right, let's have a look at some of the other fixtures this weekend. Luton are back in action tonight after missing a game week last weekend because Kenilworth Road badly needs upgrading. And they play Chelsea away tonight. Pop quiz team, when was the last time Chelsea played Luton in the league?
Must have been 1992.
Not quite.
No? 1991.
Yes.
There you go.
December 91. Oh. Luton 2, Chelsea 0. In fact, if you look at the history of Luton against Chelsea in league fixtures, which I know we all have, but just to inform the listener, I think it's like 15 wins to Chelsea and 12 to Luton, which kind of, you know, for our younger listeners, Chelsea weren't always good. Luton weren't always bad. So, it feels like Luton's still an unknown entity. I mean, they just had that game against Brighton where they lost on the opening day. Have they got the weapons to hurt a young and inexperienced Chelsea side, Nick?
Maybe. I mean, they've got a few sort of theoretically dangerous players. Colton Morris looks an absolute pain in the ass to play against.
Second time you've used that particular phrase today.
Yeah,
pains in the ass.
Sorry. Sorry for the blue language. quite difficult to think anything other, if you look at their squad, to think it's other than that just looks like a championship squad, which obviously doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be bad, but I think they've possibly been banjaxed a little bit by their having to postpone their second game. Really, you kind of think that they would need some regular games to kind of get used to the Premier League and get up to speed a little bit more. But as it turns out, their first two games are going to be away to Brighton and admittedly, as we discussed earlier, in transition Chelsea. So. Maybe if they were scheduled to play Burnley last weekend, maybe if they'd have played against a slightly more familiar opponent that they obviously know from last season, then that might have been better for them. But you know, as we've kind of seen certainly last week and elements of the first game as well, don't underestimate Chelsea's capacity to, you know, self-destruct and do something stupid. So who knows?
Yeah, Luton, tough start, but they've got a kinder September. They will have their first home game on Friday 1st of September. That's next week, home to West Ham. And then they've got Fulham, Wolves and Everton the next three in September. So that'll be a decent test of where they're at. Namdi, Arsenal's defence survived a pretty stern test late on at Palace on Monday night. Declan Rice looks like he's doing pretty well. But interestingly, Gabriel's not started either of the first two games. How do you and... Well, you're going to speak on behalf of the Arsenal fans here. How do Arsenal fans feel about that?
I would think I'd be fair to say that it's a bit puzzling. Arteta is not the most straightforward manager, so it's kind of hard to predict what he thinks or what he wants to do. But Gabriel being left out is a bit weird. I mean, before the season opener against Forest, he started our last 73 Premier League games. And yeah, he was probably one of our most consistent performers over the last 2-3 years. He does have a mistake in him, admittedly, but his performances had never dropped off to the point where we thought he'd be dropped. I think it might make a little bit of sense when you take into context the report of Saudi interest in him and seeing where his head might have been at. But also as well, the fact that Zinchenko has been injured for the start of the season, knowing how Arteta plays with an inverted fullback, instead of Tomiyasu, you can't really do that job as well as Zinchenko can. It's been Partey that's been doing that job. And so when Partey is playing at right back, the back three has normally been Ben White, Saliba and Tomiyasu until his red card on Monday. So I think if Zinchenko, who did play against Palace and probably might start against Fulham, you probably would see Gabriel come back into the team. But if not, then I think it'd be right to ask some questions.
Good stuff. Arsenal, Fulham on Saturday, then it's Man City facing Sheffield United on Sunday. After that, they play Fulham, West Ham, Forest and Wolves. Ruben, is that a 100% record for their first 7 games this season, potentially?
Yes, probably. I mean, they are missing some key players, and they're, like, you know, Stones and De Bruyne, and they're adapting to probably a new system, as I said earlier. But they've got so much quality on the pitch, and, you know, if Haaland's fit, then you'd back them to win all of those games, really. But I will watch City with with interest over the next few weeks, just to see what they do tactically. Obviously, like, Kovacic coming in to replace Gundogan, bit of a different player. Still think, like, perfectly suited to City. He looks so much more at home at City than he ever did at Chelsea, really. So yeah, I can't see City dropping any points in those games, and therefore Arsenal can't either.
even without De Bruyne?
Yeah, I think there's enough creativity in the rest of the team, and, you know, Alvarez is very good in that kind of inside right 10 position, whatever you want to call it, and you know, it's Foden's time to shine, really. Like, he needs to have a big year, because with Mahrez and Gundogan gone and now De Bruyne injured, that's three spots in a team that he could theoretically play very well in. So if he doesn't kick on and, you know, become a guaranteed starter over the next few months, then something's wrong.
Right, that's it from us. My thanks to Nick, Ruben and Namdi for coming in today. Ayo Akinwaleri will be back next week, and Adam will be back with you next Friday. Your producer today was John Rogers, with assistance from Mike Stavrou and Adam Jones, and your executive producer was Aidy Moorhead. If you liked what you heard, make sure you subscribe to The Athletic. You can sign up right now for just $1.99 a month for an entire year at theathletic.com/footballpod. Thank you for listening.
The Athletic.